Welcome to Merin Talks Money, the podcast in which people who know the markets explain the markets. I'm Merin Zamzet-Webb. This week, we speak with Sean Pesch, portfolio manager and founder at Ranmore Fund Management. Pesch has been in the investment industry since 1997, working at a variety of institutions. He established Ranmore Fund Management, his own company, in 2008. It's worth noting he has a fairly stellar record of outperformance, outperforming the index since inception and over pretty much every time period since, except for the last 12 months, which we'll discuss as we go. Sean, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Merin. Lovely to be here.
Now, listen, you have achieved fairly spectacular, as I said, outperformance over the last decade plus, despite being a value fund manager in a period when being a value fund manager has been an absolutely terrible thing to be. This has been a time for growth, yet somehow you've succeeded as a value manager. So let's talk a little bit about how on earth you've done that.
I guess if we'd had this interview back in the middle of the pandemic when everybody was sitting at home buying Apple iPhones and ordering stuff on Amazon, it'd be a different conversation. But we just try and invest in decent companies that are generating cash with management on our side and not paying too much for them. And it has, as you rightly say, been a challenging time for value managers. And I guess there are three reasons for that. The first is, if you go back to 1974, when these indices first started, value outperformed growth with a couple of hiccups along the way, pretty much in a straight line up to the end of 2007. And then you had the global financial crisis. And what happened after that was quantitative easing. And that meant interest rates collapsed. And until late 21 or so. And so during that period, if you overlay those two, average interest rates and value versus growth, you'll see that value underperformed during quantitative easing. Mm-hmm. That's the first reason. The second reason is you had these fast growing companies, Microsoft, Amazon, those kind of guys, at the same time as you had low interest rates. And so that meant their growth rates were discounted at lower rates. And they became hugely, huge companies in the markets. And the third reason is at that very time that you had these massive companies with huge market caps, passive investing just exploded. When I started the business, I think it was $1 trillion in passive investing. It's now something nearly 12. And so you had this wall of money just moving into these companies, propelling them ever further. Now, what's changed? Quantitative easing is over. Okay. We saw that reference to that in the Fed statement last week. The second thing is these companies are getting harder to, it's harder for them to grow earnings. Microsoft grew earnings per share 10% last quarter. Costco grew revenue 1% last quarter the other day. You've seen Nike falling the other day. So, it's just getting harder and harder for these giant companies to carry on outperforming in the way they have. And so we think that's a really good time to focus and turn the attention to value investing. You got to go where the puck is going to be. I mean, this is what Wayne Gretzky said, not where the puck's been. The puck has been in quality and growth. The puck is going to value. We firmly believe that.
But nonetheless, you haven't been in those companies. And one thing that really strikes me when I look at your fact sheet is the very, very small level of exposure you have to the US. So if we look at the MSCI world, that's 73% US, right? And an awful lot of that, of course, is the Mega 7, is the huge technology stocks in the US. But you don't have that. You're about 17% in the US. And if I spin my eye over to your sector exposure, information technology, 3%. That's against around 25% in the MSCI. So you are very, very far away from the index, which is great, by the way. There's nothing we love more than a fund that doesn't touch the index. If we wanted the index, we'd just buy the index, right? So we love a fund that's far away from it. But, you've really differentiated yourself then.
We have. And I guess, there are a couple of points. So how have we managed to generate those returns? Well, the first is that we'll typically go where people are less interested, because that's where we find the value. So, we made good money in Japan in recent years. We were quite early into moving into Japan when the world was focused in Japan with Warren Buffett and all of that. We were actually selling and redeploying those assets into China. And so even last month, we had more in China than the US. Hong Kong listed stocks. So I guess there's two ways to make money. The one is you can buy a company that you think is a fabulous business and hold it forever, and that company will compound its earnings. What we prefer to do is find an undervalued business, invest at the right time, ideally the right time, and when the value is fully realized, we will then sell that and compound the capital. Okay, because sometimes you can be stuck in these businesses. You think it's a great business, and look at Nike, look at Estee Lauder, look at, you know, Diageo or Unilever in recent years. You things come unstuck. And so we prefer to compound the capital, and we move the capital around. So we really don't shy away from moving our assets around the world based on where we find value. And we're not scared about turnover either. You know, if I look at some of the best money managers in the world, the likes who've survived and got fantastic track records over multi-decades, not just in recent years, you know, the likes of Paul Tudor Jones and Bruce Kovner and, you know, David Tepper and those guys. Mm. I've never, ever seen a single quote from them about low turnover being the answer.
Okay, well, that's interesting, because there's a big part of the industry that believe exactly that. Buffett style, you buy great companies and you keep them indefinitely and you let them compound until you're super rich. But of course, I mean, the answer to that, your answer might be, well, companies change. A great company doesn't stay a great company, and you have to be prepared to move out of it as soon as you see signs that it's not great anymore.
Absolutely. And Warren Buffett said, my favorite holding period is forever. Mm. He didn't say my only holding period is forever. And he sold half his Apple every day. You know, he's selling Bank of America. He's sold many positions along the way. So I think people confuse that. I mean, take it to the extreme. Some of the early good businesses that everybody knew about and loved were railroads and, you know, those steel manufacturing, etc. Where would you be today if you'd owned those forever? So, you know, we think the right business at the right time. And we've very, you know, things change. So we are not in that camp where you think you can find a great business and hold it forever, because we don't know what the future is. And as I said, you look at Nike. You know, Nike had the lunch to themselves. Now you've got competitors with On Running and Hoka and Skechers and those kind of guys. So the environment is always changing, and you have to be alert to that. And so we're not in the sit in the side and do nothing camp.
Well, let's step back a little bit, because you mentioned Japan earlier, and I know a lot of our listeners are very interested in investing in Japan, have been for a while, and John and I were, like you, very on it when it was very cheap, you know, this is value, etc. I'm going to Tokyo next week, by the way, I'll report back. But in the meantime, you say you're no longer really invested in Japan. Do you not consider that to be a value opportunity anymore?
Oh, no, we are definitely still in Japan, and we are a little overweight there. What I'm saying is we've taken profits on many of our positions and redeployed those. Mm. So, no, we still like Japan. In fact, we bought some Mazda the other day. That, again, you've got to look at the second level thinking that Howard Marks talks about. You know, a lot of the Japanese companies fell in a heap when the yen rallied and their exporters, etc. Well, you get some businesses that have used the weak yen, and that's how they've generated revenue and profit growth. And there are some businesses that are growing. And, you know, you look at the company like Mazda. I mean, its U.S. sales of its current range are up 30% in the last months. You know, and that's been like that for a little while with huge amounts of cash on the balance sheet. So there's still lots of value to be unlocked in Japan. Some of our companies had just, we felt, had run the course and reached fair value. And so we redeployed it to compound that capital.
Okay, well, let's move on to China then, where you did deploy some of that capital. It's one of the ongoing conversations John and I always have about something maybe cheap, but is it investable? Can you invest somewhere such as China, like China, where you don't necessarily have the same kind of regulatory security that you might have somewhere else? And John and I had this conversation around Russia, and I said, yes, you can. And he said, no, you can't. And he was right. And on China, I say, yes, you can. He says, no, you can't. And this week, at least, I'm right.
I love the dynamic between you guys. And I mean, unfortunately, included in our track record, we lost just over 10% in Russia, but we recovered in 2022, you know, and that's our process. And those stocks are still in the portfolio, but written down to zero. So, you know, sometimes we get it wrong. In fact, portfolio managers, you know, often get it wrong. And so we thought, and this is an interesting point. I think there was a conference in February 2024 at a Goldman Sachs conference, and they surveyed the participants, and 40% said China was uninvestable. Now, when people tell us a market's uninvestable, you know, that piques our interest, because there's got to be some diamonds in the dust. And what's interesting is, you know, government interference and regulation and all of that. And then you stand back and think about it and you go, well, when natural gas prices rallied, Ireland and the UK imposed windfall taxes on, you know, oil companies here. Just the other day, President Macron is in favor of taxes on large French companies. You've got the US Department of Justice and, you know, attacking the US tech companies. You've got the, you know, Fair Trade Commission, FTC attacking or trying to prevent mergers and takeovers. So I think this government interference and regulation and all the rest is overplayed. It's around the world. It's not just in China. And so that's our point to that. And in fact, what you don't have in many of these Asian markets, you don't have greedy management teams taking huge, you know, swathes of share options and diluting shareholders. And you don't have the short-term thinking that you have in many of the Western markets. So one needs to balance the pros and the cons. And when you get companies, I mean, I'll give you an example. In early September, we owned Alibaba and Baidu. You see those in the top 10 in the last month's fact sheet. But in early September, we were buying Ping An. And Ping An here at 5x earnings with an 8% dividend yield and trading below tangible book value for pretty much the first time ever, you know, that's how deeply out of favor it was. And we were buying it at 33 and, you know, we're selling it the other day at 55. You make 60% in a month. Now, we would quite happily hold it. We didn't want to only hold Ping An for a month. But when you've had this kind of move, you've been over-rewarded in a short space of time, we are happy to move on.
Okay. And the other market that until very recently we kept being told was uninvestable. I kept being told, particularly by American investors and the odd unreconciled remainer, that the UK was an uninvestable market. We don't hear that so much anymore. We're hearing much more positivity around the UK. Are you invested here?
We are. And, you know, we're meaningfully overweight. I think we're at 6% versus just less than 4%. Not that we worry, as I say, we worry too much about the benchmark. And, you know, we bottom-up investors, so we're less worried about the top-down and interest rates and, you know, those kind of political goings on. I suppose that's the other thing, is that China's had quite a stable, it's one of the few places in the world that hasn't had an election this year. But some of the companies there, Merin, which might be of interest, and again, my compliance officer will shout at me if I don't say this is obviously not advice, but where we do have some positions is in the, and what's deeply out of favor are the UK asset managers.
Why do you think that's out of favor? Why do you think you look at that and you see the value and other people do not?
Well, I think if you've owned Aberdeen all the way for years and you've seen one corporate acquisition after another just go wrong, you are biased. And trying to avoid biases is a key part of what we do. And so if you come in fresh and, you know, you haven't got that historic baggage, that helps you to look at things with a fresh pair of eyes. And so we'll do that. But we don't bet the ranch. We are not in the high conviction camp. You know, we are fully aware that stuff comes out of nowhere, but we think we're getting paid to wait.
Now, the other, back to traveling, another stock that I see that you are now holding is Ryanair.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Well, Ryanair, I mean, that's, you know, I remember when I first got over here from South Africa in early 2001, I mean, here was this business, was highly, highly rated. And we thought, well, goodness me, can you believe it? But look at what Michael O'Leary and his team have done. And, you know, the interesting thing for us is we don't meet management, but you didn't have to meet management. You just have to look at the return on equity that here Michael O'Leary and his team have generated in the toughest of industries, that he's built this business from pretty much nothing to transporting something like 225 million passengers a year. It's just been phenomenal, and that they didn't need, you know, lifelines from governments during the pandemic, etc. They survived. So a phenomenal management team in a great business. And I guess if the economy is tough, you know, people will trade down to Ryanair. You might not be going on first class on some other airline, but be trade going on holiday on Ryanair. So people want to go on holiday. Great management team, strong balance sheet, reasonably priced, buying back shares because they've got excess capital. And the other thing which is interesting is there's capacity constraints because, you know, Boeing and Airbus are both struggling to get aircraft out the door.
You say you don't meet management. Now, I find this very interesting. I think I understand why you do it, but I speak to an awful lot of fund managers whose USP is how many management teams they talk to. And they tell me endlessly about, well, this is what I do. I visit 60 companies a year or 100 companies a year, and I look the management in the eye, have conversations with them, and I can see if they're honest. And I can, while I'm not getting inside information, I can pick up bits and bobs of levels of confidence that other people can't see. And that is my value as a fund manager. That's how they sell themselves, how a lot of the industry sells itself, right? And you're just saying, nah, not going to bother with that. I'm just going to sit in my office and play with spreadsheets.
Yeah, Mira, next time one of those fund managers tells you that, please ask them to send a scatter plot with the y-axis showing our performance and the x-axis showing the number of meetings. And let's see if there's a direct correlation, because I suspect there probably isn't, just as there isn't a direct correlation between large teams and our performance. It sounds so good and it sounds so obvious. Oh, we meet management. I mean, in many cases, they're meeting investor relations. You know,
yes.
We want management teams to be out there running the business, not speaking to fund managers all the time. Now, that said, you know, we read conference call transcripts. We read a lot of them. So it's not like we ignore what management say. We like to look and say, okay, well, what is management saying at quarterly reports, report back periods or semi-annual report back periods? But I don't want to meet management and then think, oh, they're a good guy, and be more and more patient. We can evaluate management based on the numbers. We can see, when did this management team take over? What were return on assets and what were operating margins then? What was market share? And what is it now? Have they added value? Have they detracted value? Have they done decent deals or have they destroyed value? You know, you look at that and you go, yeah, I mean, it helps when that's how we evaluate management. So if a company is doing a stupid deal and paying way over the odds for an acquisition, you know, look at Unilever acquiring Dollar Shave Club for $1 billion, was a loss-making business. You know, you just go, this is going to destroy return on assets. It's using company cash to go and overpay for an acquisition. And this indicates that management are not of the caliber we'd like. So that's how we evaluate management, the numbers. Mm. And we leave the niceties to everybody else.
And I suppose it helps you avoid being caught up in stories, in that, really investing is just about stories, right? Stories you believe, stories you don't believe, and the extent to which a charismatic CEO can tell a good story. I mean, that's the story of tech, for example.
When the story lines up with the numbers, fantastic. But so often what will happen is, you know, you look at the numbers and you'll go, okay, things are tough. And you read the conference call transcript and you go, my goodness, am I reading this? Am I a quarter out? Is this the same period? You know, is this the same company? So they often, you know, there can be quite a spin. And I mean, even to the extent that management teams know that analysts and AI are trawling through conference call transcripts, looking for those little, you know, trying to work out, is the call positive or negative, extracting positive phrases and negative phrases. So they gear things accordingly. And if you attach yourself to a narrative, to a story, okay, how do you know when you're wrong? So if you'd said, I want to buy wind because it's part of the energy transition, and it's going to play an important part, great. It's still going to play an important part, but you've lost 70% if you bought some of the go-go wind stocks, you know, the Vestas and those types of companies way back when, or the solar. I mean, look at what a disaster solar is. So it's hard to identify when you're wrong if you just focus on the story. The numbers will tell you when you're wrong. Margins are falling, revenue's falling, it's too overpriced, etc. You know, look at these obesity drugs at the moment. What's the story? The story is we've got an obese population and there are only a couple of them that have been approved, and they're going to make $100 billion of, you know, in the next couple of years, in terms of like the basically is blue sky. Well, let's see. But there's 170 competitors all trying to develop obesity drugs. And sooner or later, that lunch will get eaten by the new competitors. And so if you're paying 40 times earnings for the likes of Novo Nordisk, you know, it's going to be hard to make a return, we think.
Also, at some point, everyone's going to be thin. The things work, right? Then that'll be that.
That's right.
And then, of course, there are knock-on effects like the diet book industry collapses. Maybe the gym business collapses.
Well, let's see. But, you know, the problem is paying too much for stories is not a good thing. And it is hazardous to your health. And so we go to whatever steps we can to avoid overpaying for storage.
Okay, there's a lot of stories around in the world of energy transition. You just mentioned that you stayed out of wind, stayed out of solar. How are you playing the transition? Or are you just sticking with oil?
Well, we've got a little bit of oil, but I mean, you know, one of the stories is we'll go by the utilities because they're going to have to generate all the power that these AI data centers are going to use. Until you look at the balance sheets of these utilities and see how much debt they've got from having, you know, installed solar and wind farms at high prices, and you go, well, I don't know if I'm going to go there. I mean, we do have a small position in Kazatomprom, Kazakhstan uranium miner. So I guess there's a bit of energy there, but we're not doing that because we think that AI demand is going to drive energy usage. You know, again, that's a theme, and we're not thematic investors, because it comes back to that story. We're rather the stock. Each stock has to make it on its own merits.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about South America, where again, looking at your weightings relative to the index, that's a big fat zero in the MSCI world, and it's 11% in your portfolio. What does that mean, or is that just Petrobras?
Well, we're not just Petrobras. I mean, we've got Bank of Colombia. It's a good bank, at an attractive price. Petrobras, you know, people were ignoring Petrobras. Everybody after that, again, it was a concern. You know, there's always an opportunity if the difference between perception and reality. The concern was, oh, Lula's coming back and he's going to do a lot of bad stuff and confiscate shares or whatever. It was shortly after you'd had the goings on in Russia and people were running from emerging markets. And but yet enshrined in their articles is that they'll pay out over 25% of cash flow as dividends. Mm-hmm. And so here you're buying one of the lowest cost producers that had paid off, used their cash in recent years to pay off their vast amounts of debt, which they'd incurred from building up their fields from 2014, the next 10 years or so. And that's paying huge amounts of dividends. And so, I mean, I think in the first year we got nearly 40% of our money back from dividends. And so, you know, who knows where oil is going to go? I guess if you'd said to me a year ago that we're going to have China stimulus and, you know, lots of tension and war in the Middle East and the Ukraine war on the go, what's oil price going to be? I'd guess a lot higher than the current price. So, you know, one's got to always recognize that these cheap solar panels are displacing some of this oil demand. And so that's uncertain. So if you're not sure where it's going to go, well, then you want to go with the lowest cost producer. And Petrobras is one of those. And you're paying, you know, very low single digit multiple for that. So with dividends. So we'll buy that.
And we're talking about so many different companies, so many different sectors, so many different countries. You're quite a small fund. And I think you're quite a small team. How on earth are you covering the entire world?
We don't waste time meeting management.
Oh, okay, fine. But, no management. That's the answer to everything.
No, but I guess it's a bit like saying, well, hang on, if you're the coach of the English cricket team, how on earth do you know all the cricketers in England?
Excellent question as well. I don't know the answer to that one either.
No, you've just got to know what you're looking for. And of course, you know, you've got to know what you're looking for, have set up your screens, and then you wait until the fish swim into your pond. And then you know those companies. And so that's what we do. You know, we're not out there worrying about benchmarks and worrying that we haven't got Meta right and Meta's big in the index and we need to, you know, form a view. If Meta doesn't tick our boxes, we don't look at Meta. End of. So that's how we do it. We just focus on the fish that swim into our pond and know those fish.
Yeah. And you don't have to worry about the index. I wrote a column recently about active versus passive. When I say a column, I mean another column. And I've written so many of them over the years. And this one was about some data that someone sent me showing that funds that are genuinely active, i.e. have an active share of 75 plus, so that shows that they're very diverse from the index, outperform on average over pretty much every time scale. And your active share is about 99. So on that basis alone.
Well, look, I read that article and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And there's one topic I'd love you to explore in detail. Maybe you have and I've missed it, but there's this notion of active fee, which is how much you pay for your active share. And I think that's the answer, because if our OCF is just over 1%, but we got a 99% active share. Well, that's one thing. But if you've got a fund next door, which has got an OCF of 75 pips, but they've got 50% active share, well, actually, you're paying them more for the active component of their portfolio than you are for us. And so active fee, I think, is an important number that a lot of people miss. Half the funds don't put their active share on their fact sheets, and don't update it on a number of things. So I think it's a hard number to come after. But this notion of, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about your returns, isn't it? You know, and I mean, I had a conversation with somebody recently and they said, oh, you're 25 bips, you're 25 basis points out the running. I said, do you know that is a 5% move on a 5% position for the whole year? I mean, that is a rounding error. So if that's what's moving the needle, then, you know, well, let's focus on something else. But there is this, I think, this excess focus on costs and this excess focus on benchmarks, because people seem to have forgotten, you know, that benchmarks also fall. I mean, since I've been running Ranmore, the S&P 500, I think, is up double digits 9 of the 15 years and only down double digits 1. And that was 2022. And 3 months later, you had AI, you know, removing that bad memory. So people have forgotten that benchmarks also fall, and performing in line with the benchmarks is not the be all and end all. It's am I getting wealthier in real terms is the key question. And if I happen to beat the benchmark, fantastic. If I don't, but I'm still getting wealthier in real terms, well, isn't that more important? You know, than going down 20% when the benchmark's falling, you know, 25 and thinking you got a good result. I mean, one of the things that, you know, as we're a boutique, we've got some $385 million under management. And when you're a small fund, obviously the costs are a higher component. Yeah. But it also means that you can, you know, you're a speedboat, not a container ship. Mm. And you're not going to get stuck in the Suez Canal. And so you can move. But, you know, with small funds, I think there needs to be a little bit of latitude for the small funds who, you know, to be able to have a slightly higher OCF to accommodate the fact that they are, you know, they still got to keep the lights on.
Yeah, I mean, I do think this is a very interesting point. It's really tough to start a new fund these days in a boutique, because a lot of the wealth managers and people who might have given you seed capital previously are not going to do it if the costs come in over 1%, because that doesn't work for them. So you've got that, and then you've got the increasingly intense regulatory overlay to opening a new fund. So there does seem to be quite a competitive moat these days. Do you think that if you were starting right now, you would find it more difficult to get going?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, definitely. It's, you know, it takes you a few years to get a rating, whatever rating. Some financial advisors won't look at you until you have a rating. You know, there is the whole scale element. So you'd have to absorb, the management company would have to absorb a lot of the costs themselves. And you've got to be doing something different. You know, I mean, how many quality growth companies are there? I look at our value peer. There's only 51 value funds, according to this Morningstar data I'm looking at, that have been around since we started. Whereas if you look at, you know, IA Global, there's 167. So you've got to be doing something different if you wanted to start today. And you've got to have some patient capital, that's for certain.
Is there anything that would persuade you to go out and buy NVIDIA?
Do you know, I'm going to tell you something, I cry myself to sleep at night knowing that in 2014, it was one of our largest positions.
Wow.
How about that? And so we spotted it way back when nobody else wanted it, because they had licensed some technology to Intel, and Intel was a big portion of their revenue. And everybody said, oh, well, they're not going to be able to renew that and all the rest. And you could buy NVIDIA on 10 times earnings. Of course, I had no idea that it was going to, you know, reach the levels that it has done, but it does highlight that, and we made money out of it, but we moved on. And so, you know, that is going to happen. And people say, well, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful if you were a buy and hold investor, you could have held on to NVIDIA and be three times the size of your fund.
Yeah.
But there are a couple of other stocks I'm glad we didn't hold on to. So, you know, you take it as it comes. You're going to get some right and you're going to get some wrong. But the good thing is our process identified it. So no, NVIDIA, no. I mean, and you know, Merrin, what, and this is a problem with many of the tech companies, and I'm actually writing a piece on this at the moment, is that I think they're far more expensive than people think they are. Because what happens is in these technology companies, you've got your stock-based compensation. They give performance unit, stock units or whatever, and to the staff. So I call it share options. And so in accounting terms, in the income statement, that's included as a cost. But these companies love to focus on free cash flow, because in free cash flow, that is added back. Okay. The problem is, what are the companies doing with the cash flow? They're buying back shares. But the buyback of shares is after the free cash flow number. And so these companies are buying back shares, but who they're buying the shares back from? And they're not buying them in the open market. Effectively, they're buying them back from employees who are exercising the options. So you have removed the cost, in terms of how profitable these businesses are from the free cash flow, but then they're using all the cash to buy back the shares. And I think I'm right in saying that one of the tech companies, I think it's NVIDIA, 2/3 of the shares that they bought back last quarter were options that have been exercised. So these companies are way more expensive than you think. They're not returning cash to shareholders. They're giving cash to employees.
Effectively, they're not. They're not returning cash to shareholders. They're bumping up their wage bill. But it doesn't quite come out like that.
Yeah. Meta, the last time I looked, they'd spent almost all their free cash flow buying back shares, and the share count had not fallen.
Yeah.
So, this is the thing. So what you actually want to do, you've got to look at that. And so that just means these companies are more expensive. And so, every day, Jensen Huang is selling 120,000 shares. Now, that's a rounding error according to his holding. But, here you've got a company with NVIDIA. Every single one of their large customers is trying to eat their lunch. At the tech bubble, and not to say that we're in a tech bubble at the moment, but you didn't have, with Cisco and their customers being AT&T and Verizon and the guys, they weren't trying to develop their own router and switch. But yet NVIDIA, all the customers are trying to develop AI, their own AI chips, Apple, Meta, Amazon, the whole lot. And so why on earth do I want to pay 35 times sales when I'm up against my biggest customers who are cash flush and cash generative, trying to eat my lunch?
Yeah, particularly when you can build a portfolio at very significantly lower valuations that you have higher expectations for.
My son was reading the little book of value investing the other day, and I said to him, what are your key takeaways? And he said, the future is unforecastable. Don't pay too much for it. And I said, well, that's exactly it. Yeah. The future is unforecastable. Don't pay too much for it. Don't be too convinced that you know what's around the corner, because history keeps reminding us we don't. And so the only way you can protect against that is by not paying too much for it.
Sean, I know that I have to ask what everybody is thinking. How old is your son?
My son is 20.
Okay. All right. Good. I'm glad he's not a teenager, because that makes me feel a lot better about my own teenagers. Gosh. They're not reading investment books of an evening. They're absolutely not. Now, listen, we have one last question. You've got 10 years. I'm going to give you a choice of two things, gold or Bitcoin.
It is definitely going to be gold. I am not in the Bitcoin camp, I'm afraid, Meron. And I'm disappointed. I'm sorry we don't have more gold mine. Well, we don't have any gold miners in the portfolio, but they have not been great businesses. They are very difficult businesses. But if I had to go for, if it's either or, it's gold all the way.
Okay. And what would make you change your mind on Bitcoin?
Nothing.
Absolutely nothing. Nothing.
I'm with Charlie Munger all the way on Bitcoin. And it's a family radio, so I better not repeat what he said. But
yeah. Okay. All right. We'll repeat that when we get to the end. Family radio. Huh, I wish.